Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was said to be the largest moving object that had ever been built. Propellers so big, they made shipbuilders look like ants. It carried poor immigrants and first-class socialites, 2,208 souls in all. But when the Titanic struck an iceberg on her maiden voyage at 11:40 p.m. on April 14, 1912, it was human vulnerability that was on display. 2 hours and 40 minutes after the impact, the great ship was gone. Only 705 people survived. This hour on Point, their story, how they survived, how they lived with the memory. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine what it must have been like that night in the years after? Are you the descendant of a Titanic survivor? Biographer Andrew Wilson joins us in a moment for survivor stories, and later this hour we'll go to the bottom of the Atlantic to look at the wreck of the Titanic now. But first, a new look at why the ship went down. Tim Malton has written a new e-book called A Very Deceiving Night. He joins us from London. Tim Malton, welcome. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. My pleasure.
Two significant natural phenomena that night, you say, may have played a very large role in what happened. What were they?
That's right. Well, the first is that there were freak high tides, the highest tides for 1,700 years in January 1912, which refloated a lot of ice along the Labrador coast. And secondly, when all that freezing meltwater flowed down into mixed with the waters of the Gulf Stream at Titanic's crash site, they created a very unusual set of atmospheric conditions known as a thermal inversion, which created a mirage.
Let's look first at the high tides. This because the Earth, at that time, was as close to the moon and the sun as it had been in 1,000 years, you say. And what, this means high tides, and this means icebergs lifted off coasts around the North Atlantic and out to sea?
That's absolutely right. This has actually been discovered by Don Olson from Texas State University. It hasn't been discovered by myself, this part of it. Mm-hmm. But yes, that's absolutely right. And he's an astronomer, and he's worked out that the highest tides for 1,700 years.
1,007, that's a long time. That would potentially set a lot of ice free from the shore. And then this mirage, this kind of cold water mirage, which comes into play maybe both in how the Titanic perceived what was out in front of it and in how the passing ship, the Californian, may have understood the Titanic. Explain that.
That's right, Tom, and you've obviously done a lot of research, so you're absolutely right. Basically, not only did it create a false horizon, which hid the outline of the iceberg below it, it also explains why the nearby Californian did not come to Titanic's aid for a number of reasons. Firstly, the ship they were looking at was very distorted, so she looked nothing like the Titanic at all, and they actually assumed she was a ship without radio. And then, tragically, the stratified air in the thermal inversion actually scrambled the Morse lamp signals between the two vessels, and in a final twist of irony, the structure of the atmosphere meant that the rockets that were 600 feet high appeared to only be half the height of Titanic's masthead light, because Titanic was looming, as we call it, in the freezing water near the surface, freezing air near the surface, and the rockets were exploding in the warm air higher up.
So first of all, this may change our notion of ineptitude on the Titanic, because the icebergs in this thermal inversion where light is actually bends down to create a mirage, that the icebergs may have looked fuzzy on a false horizon, and they might simply may not have been able to see what was coming.
That's right. The lookouts have never been believed before. They all testified that there was a slight haze on the horizon, even lookouts who were not on duty during the collision. So even lookouts who had nothing to lose, who were on duty before anything was hit, they described a slight haze on the horizon. And they were never believed because everyone else said what a clear night it was. Mm-hmm. But the haze I've discovered is consistent with a completely clear night. And in fact, the haze was caused by the sheer depth of air, the amount of molecules in the air between the lookouts and what they were seeing created a scattering of light which looked like a haze.
And if you are correct, then the crew of the Californian, which was not so far away, also looks less heartless or cavalier because, as they later said, it didn't look like a great passenger ship, and the flares that went up, the rockets, in this mirage didn't really appear to go up very high at all.
That's right, Tom. I mean, the California still has a lot to answer for, because in my view, rockets are rockets, whether they're high or whether they're low. Yeah. But you and I have the benefit of hindsight. And in 1912, my own view is that Captain Lord of the Californian thought that it was a nearer ship, a smaller ship, maybe with a slack crew who couldn't even be bothered to reply to his Morse lamp signals. And he probably thought it was safer for his own ship to wait 3 hours until daylight and then go and investigate. Had he realized it was the Titanic sinking on her maiden voyage, of course he would have thrown caution to the wind and gone down there to have a look.
A century on, some new insights about the natural surrounding of the amazing tragic events of that night that may absolve some sailors and ship passing by of the opprobrium they've had for years about what happened there. Tim Matlin brings us to us in his new ebook, A Deceptive Night. Tim, in London, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Tom. My pleasure.
We're talking about survivors of that sinking today. Here's from 1975 on BBC Radio, the Titanic survivor Edwina McKenzie recounting the moment the iceberg hit the Titanic.
I was awakened by the ceasing of the vibration of the boat, and I thought, well, something has happened. So I got out of bed, and finally I got into the lounge where some men were smoking, and they said, "What's the matter with you?" to me. Well, I said, "What's the matter with me? I want to know what's the matter with the boat." And he said, "Oh, it isn't anything. We just grazed an iceberg."
Just grazed an iceberg, that's all. And it would not be many hours before it was all gone, except those 705 who survived. With us now from Plymouth, England, is biographer Andrew Wilson, author of the new book, Shadows of the Titanic, The Extraordinary Stories of Those Who Survived. Andrew Wilson, welcome to On Point. It's wonderful to have you.
Oh, hi there. Hi, Tom.
There's so much we want to learn from you, but broadly, can we characterize who survived? Was it, in James Cameron's movie, it was the sort of the toffs who survived, right? The fancy class, and we saw lots of people almost chained downstairs. Can you make a broad characterization among the 2,200 plus of who survived?
Well, yes, you can. The vast majority of people who did survive did come from first class. The people least likely to survive were second and third class men. They didn't really have much of a chance, actually.
Because were they literally locked downstairs or just kept away from the lifeboats? What?
There were some cases of some of the staircases being locked. Then there was also the case, if you were a third class passenger, you were likely to be an immigrant, for instance. So you were traveling. Lots of people didn't necessarily understand English. They didn't understand the orders they were being given. And then lots of people actually thought it'd be much safer to be on a ship that was classified as unsinkable than to try their chances in a boat in the middle of the Atlantic, a little lifeboat.
Did those who survived, we know some of them were looked upon very critically, for not adhering to a kind of women and children first. We'll talk about that. But did that kind of tarring hit those more broadly who survived? Were they looked upon as selfish or somehow for having come out of this night alive when so many drowned?
If you were a first-class man and you survived, there were various rumours that would always go around, especially if you were in a small town. There were certain cases in small towns in America, for instance. So if you were a first-class man who survived, people would sneer, they'd gossip behind your back. And then there's also a story that went around, perhaps apocryphal, that if you were a first-class man, he was the one that wore a dress to get off the ship. He's the one that pretended to be a woman. So there were all these stories in this kind of mix that haunted people for the rest of their lives.
And you write that even those who didn't have that kind of shadow over them lived with simply being subjects of amazement for the rest of their lives, that they had survived, that they really could not get away from their Titanic experience, even though they got away from the ship.
Exactly. I mean, one of the cases I talk about is Renee Harris, who was America's first female theatrical producer. And when people discovered that she was a Titanic survivor, that was it. That was how she was defined. It didn't really matter whether she was an extraordinary woman in her own right, a career woman who'd built up a string of theatres in New York. That didn't really matter. The only thing that mattered to people was the fact she was a Titanic survivor.
You look at how many people were deeply affected, no small number crushed by this experience, even though they survived it. But on balance, what's your sense? We'll look at the individual stories, but on balance, did humans prove themselves to have the tenacity, the capacity, flexibility to survive this psychologically whole, or was it just too much for most survivors?
I think for most survivors, I think it probably was the most terrible thing that could possibly happen in all their lives. And that's why I call my book Shadow of the Titanic, because even if you had a relatively easy, inverted commas, survival, you didn't have such a traumatic time. Just the noise of listening to 1,500 people go to their deaths, that haunted people forever.
You write about that at length right at the top of the book, and we'll talk about it. It is an amazing thing to try and throw our minds back to that night, that keening and shouting and horror over the waters of the North Atlantic. Andrew Wilson's new book is Shadows of the Titanic, The Extraordinary Stories of Those Who Survived, and we will come back and hear them. You can join us. Can you imagine what that night must really have been like? Can you imagine surviving? We'll go out with a 1924 recording of the folk ballad, The Titanic, sung here by Ernest Stoneman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
When they were building the Titanic, they said, what they could do. They were going to build a ship that the water could not go through. But God with his mighty hand showed to the world it could not stand. It was sad when that great ship went down. It was sad when that great ship went down. The burns in my little kingdom are still alive. It was sad when that great ship went down.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour, a century after its famous sinking, about Titanic survivors, how they did it, what they saw, how they lived with the memories of that night and the Titanic going down. Andrew Wilson joins us from Plymouth in the United Kingdom. He's author of the new book, Shadow of the Titanic, The Extraordinary Stories of Those Who Survived. And you can join the conversation. Can you imagine that night? The shock, the disbelief, the reality. Who do you picture surviving? How do you imagine them doing it? And can you imagine living with the memory of that night through the rest of your life? Are you descended from a Titanic survivor? What did they tell you? We never stop imagining it, thinking about it. Season one of the PBS hit series Downton Abbey starts in April 1912 with the sinking of the Titanic. Here's an exchange.
Is it true what they're saying?
I believe so, my lord.
I'm afraid we'll know some people on it. I don't suppose there are any lists of survivors yet.
I understand most of the ladies were taken off in time.
You mean the ladies in first class? God help the poor devils below decks. On their way to a better life. What a tragedy.
A dramatic recreation of the news being taken on board. But here is one of the survivors Andrew Wilson writes about. This is Edith Russell, a fashion journalist. She was 33 when she boarded the Titanic as a first-class passenger in 1912. In a 1970 interview with the BBC, she recalled how passengers did not at first take their encounter with the fatal iceberg seriously.
I saw a large grey, well, it looked to me like a building floating by. Great big grey thing. But that building kept bumping along the rail, and as it bumped, it sliced off bits of ice, and ice fell all over the deck. And I, and a great many of my foolish fellow passengers, we just picked up the ice and started to play snowballs. We thought it was fun.
Throwing snowballs with the ice from the iceberg that would take down the entire ship there. One of the survivors, Edith Russell. Andrew Wilson, tell us about Edith Russell. Let's dive in on these stories. What happened with her?
She was an extraordinary woman. A number of years after the Titanic sank, she became increasingly obsessed with the Titanic and telling the story. And she wanted to write her memoir. And when Walter Lord's book came out in 1955, she was rather cross because she thought the thunder had been taken and stolen from her. And over the years, she corresponded with Walter Lord desperately trying to get her story to be told. But of course, nobody in those days was interested in what they saw as yet more Titanic survivor memoirs. I mean, Walter Lord had done a fantastic job with A Night to Remember in 1955. Mm-hmm. But she became increasingly, I suppose, unhinged is the word. She lived in a hotel in London and surrounded herself with lots of packing cases and newspapers, lots of material about Titanic. She would feed pigeons in her room. And quite eccentric character, but quite charming in many, many respects, and a great sense of humour. I would love to have met her.
Let's hear, here's tape from the most senior officer to survive the sinking of the Titanic. This was Commander Charles Herbert Lightoller. This was 1935. Great recording quality, though, as he describes the moment when the ship went under to the BBC.
Slowly she reared up on end, till at last she was absolutely perpendicular. Then, quite quietly, but quicker and quicker, she seemed just to slide away under the surface and disappear. As she vanished, everyone round me on the upturned boat, as though they could hardly believe it, just said, "She's gone."
Gone, that great ship in the middle of the night in the North Atlantic, and many souls still alive and struggling around. What about the officers and crew of the ship and survival rates there, Andrew?
It was, I think, about a third of the crew survived, so the vast majority of them did go down with the ship. Obviously, the captain died. Andrews, who was the chief designer, he died. But Ismay, who was the owner of the White Star Line, he survived, much to his disgrace.
This is J. Bruce Ismay, whose father had created the White Star Line, built the Titanic, as you write, as an act of hubris, and survived. But within days, you report, one newspaper ran a full-page cartoon of him showing him in a lifeboat with the sinking ship behind him, accompanied by the caption, "Not J. Bruce Ismay," but said, "This is J. Brute Ismay." What happened to his life?
So he was branded a coward immediately as he set foot on American soil. And he was basically a scapegoat for the whole disaster. He was emotionally fragile. And I think from that moment on, he became something of a specter. Like a frozen corpse, his granddaughter described him as. I interviewed his granddaughter, Pauline, and she described him as this one of an extraordinarily absent character, really, just nothing more than a spectre. And he was shunned by society, as I say. He would seek out the company of tramps and vagrants in London parks. If he travelled by train, the blinds would be closed. And he led a very unhappy and basically empty life for most of his life until he died in 1937. Interestingly, the word Titanic was banned from the household. Nobody could mention it at all. But then, interestingly, in 1936, I think it was, his grandson asked him a question at the dinner table one day. He said, "Grandad, were you ever in a shipwreck?" And obviously, at this point, the atmosphere turned icy cold. And he said, "Yes, I was once on a ship that was believed to be unsinkable." And those were the first words he'd uttered about the Titanic in 25 years.
Ignominy, the fate of J. Bruce Ismay as a survivor. Here's tape of Eva Hart. She was 7 years old when she got on the Titanic in April 1912 with her mother and father. Her father went down with the ship. This is a 1990 interview where she remembered what it was like to be in the lifeboat while the Titanic went down.
"One in that boat and two in that and three in that, and I got separated from my mother. And that was the most terrifying thing to happen to a child. But the most dreadful sound of all is the sound of people drowning. The screams. Absolutely ghastly. My mother used to say sometimes, she couldn't get me to talk about it for years, but if ever anyone did talk to me, I said that, she used to say yes. But do you remember the silence that followed it? And that's quite right. It says the whole world stood still that night. Once the lights had gone, the ship had gone, the sound had gone."
And just the lifeboats bobbing in the great North Atlantic in the middle of the night, Eva Hart there, she was seven at the time. The sound of those survivors and then the silence when it was all gone. Andrew Wilson, you just have survivor after survivor talking about this as the most haunting thing. One who could never go to a baseball game again because the sound of the crowd shouting in the stands reminded him too much of that crowd dying in the night.
Yes, that's right. I think that's Frank Goldsmith, who actually said, you know, he grew up near Tiger Stadium in Detroit, and he said that, you know, he could never go to another game after that. It was just such a sound that would haunt him forever.
Let's go to our listeners. They're calling in from around the country. Novelle in Newton, Massachusetts. Novelle, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My grandfather was on the Titanic and was a survivor. He was in third-class steerage.
Wow.
And he actually was a quartermaster on the ship, the New York, which almost collided with the Titanic. But he was born in Sweden, and he was a naturalized U.S. citizen. And he's on the manifest for the Titanic. And he was actually, what happened was that he was able to get up on the deck, and he jumped into the water at 2:17. He was wearing a watch,
mm-hmm.
and the watch, of course, stopped at 2:17.
And then presumably some lifeboat pulled him up? Is that what happened, Nobel?
Well, what happened is he jumped in the water, and he was able to survive because he had had naval survival training in the U.S., and he five other seamen who were with him in the New York were with him going back to the United States, and they didn't survive, and he always thought it was because they didn't have this survival training. But what happened is he was on Collapsible A, and Collapsible A did not fit. He was picked up by Collapsible
A. This is the collapsible lifeboat, yes.
Yes, and so it did not fully inflate, and so about half of the people on Collapsible A died just because they were in cold water.
What was your grandfather's name, Novelle? What was his name?
His name was Henry H. Tornquist.
And did
Tornquist.
And did he speak? Did he speak
on the mm-hmm. on the manifest? Mm-hmm. His name was written as Tornquist, William H. Tornquist.
Did he speak?
T-U-R-N-Q-U-I-S.
Did he speak of that experience to you or to your
parents? He died when I was 2 years old.
Okay.
So he did speak about it to my grandmother. He did not like to talk about it. He was interviewed by a Globe reporter, and he had many very descriptive and awful things to say that happened. One of them, I'm looking at an article right now that says, died like rats in steerage. He said that those in steerage, most of them did not succeed in getting up to the decks to even jump overboard.
And 1,500 and more died. Novelle, we really appreciate the story directly from your family there. Andrew Wilson, you've looked at so many stories. What do you hear in this one?
That's great. I mean, I think it was extraordinarily lucky that somebody who was actually in that situation, he was traveling in steerage, so he was extraordinarily lucky. And then to be on Collapsible A as well, as the caller said, most of the people on that boat froze to death.
You tell the story of Jack Thayer. Now, this was a first-class passenger, but who did not take a place in the lifeboats, waited until the very end, and then himself jumped off the ship. What happened then?
So, yeah, extraordinary story of survival. Yes, as you say, he was 17 at the time, and lost his father in the sinking. He went on to work in banking. He became part of Philadelphia University, I think, as vice president, had a few children, and by all accounts had a very happy life. But then in 1943, his son was flying across the Atlantic in the Second World War. His plane was shot down over the sea, and the memories of that night all came flooding back, obviously the memory of being in the water. And then, in addition to that, his mother died 6 months later, bizarrely enough, on the anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. This brought on an episode of depression, which he couldn't wrench himself out of. And then, very sadly, one day in 1945, when he was only 50, he drove down to the streets of Philadelphia, where he slashed his wrists and his throat. I interviewed his daughters, who have very fond memories of him, but they describe him as just being terribly unhappy, obviously, and he couldn't wrench himself out of this very deep depression.
In a way, the Titanic came back and got him all those years later. And tell us the story of Annie Robinson. She was a stewardess on the Titanic, survived, and then...
Yes, and bizarrely, she'd already survived one collision with an iceberg just a few years before. So the Titanic was her second iceberg collision. So as we know, she survived that disaster. And then in 1914, 2 years after the sinking of the Titanic, she was sailing into Boston Harbor to visit her daughter who lived in Boston. And it was a very foggy night. The foghorn was blaring out. It brought back memories of the night the Carpathia, the rescue ship, was coming into New York, which was also a very foggy mm-hmm. night. And she couldn't stand it any longer. She ran up on deck and actually threw herself from the ship into Boston Harbor.
Amazing. Amazing. This is just 2 years after surviving on
the
Titanic.
And she was the first of 10 Titanic survivors who went on to commit suicide.
Orion Green joins us right now from Arlington, Massachusetts. She's a descendant of Titanic survivors Clara Hayes, her great-grandmother, and Orion Davidson, a great-aunt. Orion Green, thank you very much for being with us.
It's nice to be here, Tom.
How do you look back? What stories help you look back, family stories, on the fact that they survived?
Well, actually, there were very few family stories. When we were growing up, I guess my mother told us about it. My great-grandfather, Charles Hayes, and my great-uncle, Thornton Davidson, perished. Mm-hmm. My mother gave us the outlines, but basically said, it's not something we talk about. Don't ask about it. And so basically we never did, which, looking back, seems a little strange since I was in my teenage years mm-hmm. in the 50s mm-hmm. when the Walter Lord book came out and the two movies, which I know I saw, but we didn't talk very much about it. So most of what I've actually learned, I learned from reading and also from being interviewed and going up to Montreal with the Canadian Broadcasting System and then later down to the Titanic Museum with a group of other descendants yeah. of Titanic passengers.
Your great-grandfather, Charles Hayes, was a wealthy Canadian railroad builder. There's been so much attention paid to the, by and large, the different fates of first class and those in steerage. Now, he died, so there
yes.
was and so did your great-uncle.
Right.
But how do you process the sort of class factors of what happened that night?
Well, it's been a little strange, I have to say. The onus for a man, especially in first class, to survive mm-hmm. was so great that there are stories, and you've just heard a couple, of people who never kind of came to grips with it. My great-grandfather is quoted as having said the ship was unsinkable. And so when the time came, he put his wife and daughter on one of the last lifeboats, Lifeboat 3, to leave the ship and said, another ship is coming. The Titanic will last for hours. We'll see you later. So my great aunt Orion said, we never even kissed them goodbye, which I find very poignant in.
I do too, Orion.
In retrospect. She was a great talker with a fascinating life and told all kinds of stories. And I knew her quite well, but she never mentioned the Titanic.
Orion Green, you've given us chills right here today, and we appreciate your sharing that story of the survivors in your family. Andrew Wilson, please stand by in Plymouth, UK. We're talking about survivors of the Titanic sinking. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour, a century after its famous sinking, about Titanic survivors, how they did it, what they saw, how they lived with the memories of that night and the Titanic going down. Andrew Wilson is with us. His new book is Shadow of the Titanic, The Extraordinary Stories of Those Who Survived. And there's a great gallery of photographs as well from the ship and the aftermath at our website. You should check it out, onpointradio.org. You can join this conversation. What do you think that night must have been like? And can you imagine living with the memory of it? What's your question on the sinking and survivors a century on? What's the meaning of the Titanic? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Of course, it will be this weekend, absolutely the centennial of that sinking. Lots of response here online. Kai writes us from listening from Belfast, Ireland, says, I drive past the shipyard where the Titanic was built every day on my way to work. It's quite desolate now. Many people in Belfast still take pride in the Titanic being built here. Kai writes, I see nothing to boast about when a ship sinks after its first voyage, though I hope you were listening earlier, Kai, when we heard there may have been some extraordinary natural circumstances intervening. Sandy writes to us, my grandpa, Arthur Gray Sr., then a young investment banker, had a ticket and was deeply disappointed when he arrived at the pier to see the ship already cast off and on her way. A few days later, he was very glad he missed the boat. I'm sure others were as well. Let's go to Sonia in Lexington, Massachusetts. Sonia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to let you know about my husband's great-grandfather, who was ambassador to France at that time.
Okay.
And he left his post a little early, so the new ambassador was on his way. And my husband's great-grandfather and his wife and daughter headed over to England, and they were set to board the Titanic the next day. And they got a telegram from the new ambassador saying, I need your help, you know, could you please return?
Yeah.
And they were up until midnight discussing whether or not to board or to go back to France. And, of course, it was a big social event. Oh, the Astors are going, and the So-and-sos are going.
Yes.
So, of course, the daughter and wife were desperate to go. And he felt that it was his obligation to return to France and help the new ambassador. And all of their luggage was on the Titanic. And the people who took their room perished.
Wow. So their luggage went down, a small loss that, and those who took their room gone, and your family survives.
Yes.
It's a great story, Sonia. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. What was his name?
Robert Bacon.
Robert Bacon, U.S. Ambassador to France.
For Theodore Roosevelt.
Amazing. Wonderful story, and thank you for it. Let's go to Norfolk, Virginia, and Anne. Anne, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. A fascinating program. In my family lore, I think the accordion player with the band was, of course, he went down and died. My family was from Bristol,
mm-hmm.
and I just wonder if you had research that might have revealed either a Jeans or a Stevens, because I'm unsure which of those two last names
mm-hmm.
the band player would have had, and if there is new material available, and how I might research this.
Let me put it to Andrew Wilson. What about the fate of the band, the orchestra band on the ship? And do you know Gene Stevens, maybe somebody from Anne's family?
As we all know, every single band member died with the ship. They famously played as the ship went down. But I think if Gene wants to do any more research, probably the best place to start is Encyclopedia Titanic, which has a biography of every single passenger on board, and that's an online resource which is free, and it's a great starting point.
The legend is that they played Nearer My God to Thee as the ship went down. Is it possible to know if that's true? Do survivors tell the story?
Some people say they heard that song being played. Some people say it was a mixture of kind of ragtime songs. And then some people said they heard nothing at all. So we have to sort of approach that with a little bit of suspicion, I think. We can totally understand why there's a collective need for wishing that were to be true. But as a historian, I think there's a question mark over that point.
Our caller mentioned, I mean, this was the maiden voyage of the great, great ship. It was a social event. John Jacob Astor, one of the richest men in the world, was on it with his second wife when she was 18 years old, Madeline, 5 months pregnant. He went down. She survived. Tell us the story.
Extraordinary story. So he was more or less the richest man in the world at this point. Obviously, he died in the shipwreck, and she survived. She came back to New York a widow and a very, very rich woman. So she was set to inherit the equivalent, I think, of about $100 million today.
Okay.
That was a trust fund, on condition that she would never marry again. And she was 18 years old. She played the part of the grieving widow to perfection for a number of years, but then she decided to renounce her great fortune and marry a childhood sweetheart. That marriage produced two sons, but after a number of years, she was bored. She divorced him, and she took up with an Italian prize fighter called Enzo Fiamonte, which literally means fiery mountain, and he was indeed a very fiery character. He was much, much younger. He was penniless. He was married and had a child. And when the couple went to Italy, both of them were nearly arrested on suspicion of bigamy, because obviously the Italian church didn't recognize either of their divorces. He started to beat her. She was covered in bruises. Even on her wedding day, she had to get married from a hospital bed because he'd beaten her up. So it's a terribly toxic relationship. She used him as a possession. He was good looking. He was very handsome. He obviously looked to her fortune. She was still a very rich woman, even though she'd renounced her claim to the Astor Millions. And unfortunately, after their divorce, he sold the story of their marriage together to a tawdry monthly magazine called True Story magazine, which told the whole secrets of their marriage. And that was the thing that finished her off. And she died in the 1940s. Some people suspect a suicide and overdose, but there's no proof of that.
Andrew Wilson, after looking at all these survivor stories from the Titanic, what lessons have you taken away about human nature or characters, and which proved the most resilient in the aftermath of witnessing that terrible night? What kind?
It just shows you the kind of the range, the extraordinary variety of human reaction, I think. I mean, none of us know how we're going to react in such a situation. Hopefully none of us will have to prove ourselves. I think it also shows you the strength of character that some people have. Some people went on to lead incredibly happy lives, even though they'd been up against a traumatic situation and face to face with death. So I think the big lesson is we never know how we might react, and it's just a matter of the grace of God, how we do react. I'd like to think there's some stories about how people survived the Titanic. Either I'd like to be somebody like Jack Thayer, who'd wait until the very last minute, I think, just diving off the ship and taking my chances, or the chief baker, who I think downed a bottle of gin and waited to the last minute and then stepped off the ship, and then he survived as well. So there's two
story.
Very different stories there.
How did he survive with a bottle of gin in him? Did he just happen to step straight into a lifeboat?
No, he just stepped into the water, literally into the water, and then swam to the nearest lifeboat. Initially, Jack Thayer said he saw this character and said, "There's one man I'll never see again," just assuming that because he'd drunk this bottle of gin, he would be completely hopeless. But actually, it gave him the courage and maybe a tiny bit of body warmth as well. So he was managed to step off the ship into the water and to the nearest lifeboat.
They're incredible stories, and many of them in Andrew Wilson's new book, Shadow of the Titanic. We're really grateful for your research and your time today, Andrew. Thanks so much for joining us from the UK there in Plymouth. Thank you very much indeed.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Andrew Wilson, Shadow of the Titanic is his book, The Extraordinary Stories of Those Who Survived. In a moment, we'll look at the wreck of the Titanic, more than 2 miles down at the bottom of the Atlantic. This is On Point. So, the Titanic has been resting at the bottom of the Atlantic for a century, as of this coming weekend. For 73 of those years, the location of the Titanic was unknown. In 1985, it was discovered. 2 years ago, the site was mapped. The level of preservation is said to be amazing. Fine china and fancy outfits, frozen in time. Joining me now from Houston, Texas, is James Delgado. He was the chief scientist for the big multi-million-dollar mapping expedition of the Titanic sinking site in 2010. He dove down to see the Titanic firsthand in 2001 and is now responsible for the U.S. government's decisions on preserving the wreck as the Director of Maritime Heritage at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Office of National Marine Sanctuaries. James Delgado, Jim, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What's it look like when you go down there? First of all, can you see anything outside the beam of your lamp?
Well, when you go down and you're in a sub, you see a porthole view, literally, of Titanic. You are getting a brief glimpse lit up and through a small 4-inch diameter port, and that's the way we've interacted with and understood Titanic over the last 3 decades. Some wonderful artwork by Ken Marshall has given us a more expansive view, but it's not the same as a detailed map or the kinds of incredible 3D images that Woods Hole's Advanced Imaging and Visualization Lab have now generated.
What shape, when it first came down, what kind of pieces, what hit the bottom, and what was the terrain at the bottom of the Atlantic there?
Well, the bottom down there is this muddy plain, largely flat in the area where Titanic came to rest, a thick mud, almost like modeler's clay with a light layer of silt. Mm-hmm. Into this almost desert-like area, Titanic fell, its bow coming down and plowing into the seabed at about a 20-degree angle and then slamming in and flexing. The stern fell as well, spiraling and shedding pieces as part of it disintegrated, and then that slammed down almost stern first, or the propellers first, into the mud with all of the other pieces raining. And for the next few hours, I mean, the bow and the stern, the big pieces came down fast, but the lighter stuff fell at a slower rate, the last pieces coming down most probably being linoleum, tiles, and people.
What's the radius of the wreckage down there?
You're looking at something that covers roughly 200 acres, which in and by itself is not that great when you consider how big Titanic was. And in that distribution of the site, we learned a number of things, particularly not only how Titanic fell apart, but what exactly lies down there, what's scattered on the seabed, and also, very importantly, what's not scattered on the seabed.
Meaning what?
Meaning that the bulk of Titanic as it was, as a floating community of some 2,200 people, remains inside the ship. Titanic, when it broke, as it flexed, had about 10% of the hull disintegrate, and that's what fell to the bottom, with much of what was in that area falling with it. But most of everything else, the bulk of the cargo, the passengers' baggage, many of the interior spaces, as James Cameron's explorations have shown us, remain inside Titanic. It is essentially still a time capsule.
Are there two big chunks then? Is that how to visualize it?
You can visualize it as two pieces separated by about a quarter mile. There's the bow, roughly a little better than 400 feet long, which is substantially intact and looks much as it did when it fell, though there have been some changes, obviously, because of time and corrosion.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also have the stern, which is much more heavily damaged because it struck hard, and it may have also suffered some implosion as pressure increased and all of its cabin spaces were not flooded completely when it went down.
And what about inside the staterooms then, and the many sort of varied facilities of Titanic? What's been found there?
Well, James Cameron's explorations have given us stunning views of obviously decaying cabins and staterooms, and yet in the case of the cabin of Isidore and Ida Strauss, as you can see in National Geographic, the clock is still on the mantle. There's another room where there's a bed, and this frame is still there, and the remains of somebody's nightgown still lies draped over the metal, preserved through some unique chemical reaction. You've got wood, partially consumed by marine organisms, but preserved because of the lead-based paint on the wood, which keeps paneling in place, doors hanging off of hinges, and in one case, a large storage cabinet with dishes still stacked inside it, and another in a woman's cabin with her glass facing up, not down as the stewards would leave it, indicating that, as she said, she survived, that her habit each night was to take that glass by the bedside, put it into that rack, and fill it with a little bit of whiskey.
What was your emotional reaction, Jim, when you went down to Titanic in 2001?
I think, like all scientists, you approach things as pragmatically and without as much emotion as perhaps you would like to think you have.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no escaping when you are down there the reality of Titanic and what happened on that night. And any human being that goes there, I think, is compelled powerfully by the realization that it's not a story. It's exactly where it happened. And for me, there were places that, because you do know the stories from the survivors, that speak to you. The area around Lifeboat 8, where Isidore and Ida Strauss did not get into the boat. I mean, she did and then stepped out, and they chose to go off together and die because their love was so strong. And that's just a story, perhaps, until you're there. And if you've ever experienced love and loss, as I think many people have, that's a story that speaks to you powerfully. And so I think many people that go, myself included, are emotionally struck powerfully by the place, and a number of people cry. And I'll say, in the area where the Strausses were, I cried.
It's 100 years this weekend since it went down. We just got half a minute. What happens to Titanic now? I mean, does it eventually disappear? What's the future?
Well, hopefully Titanic will not disappear. I don't think it's going to disappear anytime soon. The rates of corrosion people have talked about, I think, are exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
We have to worry a bit about people loving Titanic to death, as Bob Ballard has cautioned us. And so what's been proposed, and there's legislation now in the Senate, and maybe it'll be picked up in the House, to set Titanic aside as an international preserve, a memorial, a sanctuary, if you will, with us offering guidelines and thoughts as to how to safely visit it, and then work with the public interest in mind to see what happens in the future in terms of additional research.
James Delgado, we're grateful to you for joining us on the eve of this centennial anniversary. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
James Delgado, chief scientist of the 2010 Titanic mapping expedition. He dove himself down to the wreck in 2001. We'll go out this hour with Nearer My God to Thee, the hymn that legend has it the band played as Titanic went down. This version is from the soundtrack to the 1997 film Titanic. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Gentlemen, it has been a privilege playing with you tonight.